The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, as Peggy said, they've been talking an awful lot about the G word, about gold lately. And our next guest is someone that you might remember. I guess it's probably about a year and a half ago we had him on for the first time. And I told you that I had heard him give a speech at a debt conference in Florida. And I thought that he's one of the most intelligent people I'd ever heard. And I was particularly amazed because he's a young man. He's not 65 and 70 years old like a lot of those guys out there that are spouting things on CNBC. David is relatively young, but he's extremely bright. He has quite the background. In fact, I would recommend that you go to look him up on McElhaney Financial.
McElhaney
Financial. How do you say
McElhaney?
I'm looking through this. I can't see because of my glasses, but I'm looking at the website here.
There's a big smudge
Get that from him. But I recommend that you go look at David McElhaney's background because it is unbelievable. One of the things I want to point out to you, because we're kind of used this here and talking to him in just a second, but he went to Oxford University where he studied philosophy and political theory. And that has got to be interesting. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mike. That very generous comment.
You're truly one of the brightest people I've ever met.
And he's a Colorado guy.
Yes, he is a Colorado guy. Political theory. When you study political theory, what is that? And is that helping you analyze what's going on now?
Well, you know, as you said in the last segment, there's a certain amount of dishonesty in politics. And if you look back at the history of politics, it's really not a certain amount. It's almost 100%. It's just a question of how you communicate, how you use propaganda to bring a message to the people. And propaganda is not always bad, but it does allow you to send certain messages. And you have to be aware and cognizant as the person who's receiving the message what exactly was intended. And we're in a very interesting transition right now. I'd look at 2016 as a critical year. We're seeing transitions not only in politics and culture, but also in geopolitics and, of course, some very significant trend changes, which I would view as transitions in the markets as well, stocks, bonds, and precious metals.
So what are the transitions that you see? Because I just look at it as a crazy election. I mean, that you know, where both candidates are not well-liked, and frankly, when you see them on television, the partisan people just are literally beating up on each other. There's just no respect for either side. How do you view this this election coming up?
Well, if you take yourself up to about 40,000 feet, you see it's not just in the United States that we have changes that are occurring in the area of politics and culture. The rise of populism, you see it in the UK as it was expressed with the Brexit vote. You also see it in Italy with the rise of the five-star movement. You see it in France with the National Front, Spain, Podemos, Greece, their group is Syriza, and then, of course, Trump and Sanders were sort of at the front edge originally, and now it's become what we have with Trump and Clinton. You're right, both of them are not really well-liked, but the common denominators in all of these countries are weak economic variables with the general public, let's call it the vast middle class, being somewhat disenfranchised. They haven't received the full benefit of the monetary policy efforts that have been in play for the 7-8 years, and they're basically saying we're mad and we're not going to take it anymore.
And do you think it's going to last through the voting? And what I'm trying to say here is that, you know, people complain about politics all the time, and they complain about whoever's in power, and they could do better, and they want things different, but they turn around and vote the same way they always have in the past. So, it's kind of the definition of, you know, Einstein's definition of insanity. Do you think people are actually ready to take a stand to do something different this time?
Yeah, it's interesting because with both political parties in the United States, and I say both, obviously there's more than two, but two that have sort of monopolized the space for some time, you're seeing on the left, you have a far left, which is gaining a larger audience. On the right, a far right, which is also gaining a larger audience. And it just speaks to the DNC and the RNC not really capturing what is going on. They've lost the sensitivity to their voter base. And it does present the possibility of third parties, either on the left or the right, emerging on the other side of this election. And what people just say, look, we're not well represented. People who took office, they're not representing us. The real issue, I think, coming into the financial markets and the transition 2016 and 2017 is we have had, if you look back to sort of the 1960s and early 1970s, the war on poverty. And we're moving into an era where we're going to have a similar sort of war on inequality, where you have to see a transfer of assets from the wealthy to the poor. And that's going to be demanded by voters, just something that is more fair. But I think there's going to be massive consequences in the financial markets as a result.
Now, what kind of massive consequences are you looking for?
Well, you know, when you see uncertainty, when the baton is passed off, you know, we saw this happen. If you were watching the Olympic Games down in Brazil, some fascinating races. But when you have the Oval Office transition, you can also have some very difficult baton passes, if you will. And if you look back to the year 2000 and 2008, very interesting, you went from the transition from Clinton to Bush, and then fast forward from Bush to Obama. Both of those transitions were marked, as you're looking at October, November, December, with about a 40 to 45% correction in the stock market, if you're looking at the S&P 500. And what the market was telling you is, because we have a change, and we can't really get our minds around what the next 2 years of policy changes are going to be, we have uncertainty. And with uncertainty, we'd rather move to the sideline. So I think you are actually in a very interesting phase shift, if you will, in the stock market, where people are saying, look, if it's Trump, I just don't know what that means exactly. Clinton, it may be more of the same. But on the other hand, she's going to have to step up her game. You've talked about the transition from monetary policy to fiscal policy, and that is going to be a pretty big transition. Again, we don't know what that's going to look like exactly. And anytime we don't have answers, we have uncertainty and more people moving to the exit.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because all of these major banks have come out over the summer and basically said the same thing, that central bank monetary policy isn't working and they're really looking for governments to open up their spigots. But do you think that that Hillary Clinton, assuming Hillary Clinton were to get in, do you think she believes that?
I think both of them believe that major infrastructure investments need to take place. I think they're looking at a low rate environment and say, look, if we do have to finance it, we're going to do it on very reasonable terms.
Right.
We can afford the debt. And the reason they think they can afford the debt is because of interest rates being so low. So the monetary policy still has its footprint in the marketplace,
right,
because financing all this stuff is apparently so cheap.
Right. Now, what do you think about the deficits, David? I know you cover a lot of things. Do the deficits concern you, the fact that, well, I guess any day now we can hit across $20 trillion? Does it concern you that we're creating deficits of this magnitude?
Well, I think we're talking about something that goes beyond a math equation and steps into the realm of moral philosophy. We're setting our future generations up for carrying a burden which is very, very difficult. And that's an issue. If
right,
we're setting up future generations with these kinds of burdens, we have to ask ourselves the question, is this the proper disposition, thinking of the future, thinking of our children, thinking of, because look, there's only a few ways that you can deal with these kinds of debts. You can either grow your way out of them, which would be very difficult at this point. You can, on the other hand, you can inflate your way out of them, and that appears to be a growing probability, or you can simply default. And I don't think we'll default. I think, in fact, we could see the attempt to inflate our way out. And you're already seeing indications of that with Williams, among others.
David, if you'll hang on, we'll have to cover that on the other side of the break. Back in a moment, folks.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
If you listen to the last segment, you know why I said that this gentleman is really, truly one of the smartest people I've ever met. I heard him speak many years ago. As I said, I've got to have him on the show. We had him on the show then. We're fortunate to have him back. We've got Mr. David McIlvaney with us today. And David has a new book coming out, and we talked about it a little bit during the break. It's fascinating, so I'm going to ask him to take a second and talk about it right now, folks. And it's not quite available yet. You can go to David's site and probably kind of follow when it's going to be available. And then when it does become available, I'm going to announce it on the show several times to let you know. But, David, the book's called The Intentional Legacy. Can you share a little bit with the folks what the book is going to be about?
Absolutely. Well, the focus on legacy for most people is looking at how you create something of a financial worth, physical capital to pass from one generation to the next. And I take a slightly different view to that, and I say basically legacies are not lost or challenged because of broken bank accounts, but because of broken relationships. There are other resources that have to be managed very well in order to see a legacy pass from one generation to the next. So you're talking about the intellectual life of the family, the spiritual life of the family, the emotional life of the family. More is accomplished sitting at the dinner table than sitting at the boardroom with a banker and with a lawyer and with an accountant. And so I think when you look at the resources that you're creating and managing, it's very easy to focus on what is on a physical capital balance sheet, if you will, and neglect the other balance sheet items, which are even more important, again, that tie directly into relationships.
Okay, sounds like a great book. We're looking forward to reading it because you're going to cover areas, I think, that no one else has covered. So it's great that you've taken the time to write this. Let's move on to, I'm sorry?
Just so you know, it'll be available November 7th. It'll ship as early as November 7th before the holiday season. And it's a great topic, I think, to be thinking about as you head into family time. Just what do you want? How do you get there? What's the next step in terms of creating better family dynamics that ultimately undergirds and supports an effort to pass a legacy from one generation to the next?
Yeah, and it's really important to plan for the future. I was just reading an article this morning about if you have a special needs child, for instance, that you have to plan for multiple generations. You just can't plan for where you are today. And so you're right. I think there's been a lot more emphasis at all levels for many, many reasons to go into greater depth of what the future looks like for our family. So, folks, I'm going to encourage you to get the book, and on November 7th, we're going to check with David. It's available. We'll tell you where to get it, and would make a great Christmas present. David, speaking of Christmas presents, I guess, for those that own gold, they've gotten a reprieve. Things didn't look too good at the beginning of the year. Now, however, gold's at $1,325. Now, I can remember one thing. The last time we had you on, there was a lot of gold fever going on. In fact, I think they were still running gold commercials back then. And you made the statement, which I think showed tremendous integrity, because your family's very actively involved in gold. For those of you that don't know this, David is CEO of McIlvany Financial Companies, which includes the International Collectors Associates, ICA Europe. He is actively involved in gold, but you made the statement then that it wasn't a good time to invest, and you were absolutely correct. What do you think of the precious metal now?
Well, I think we've seen a pretty significant transition. Some things that I would point out, obviously you can look at the price action from January to the present, and we've had a good 25, 26% move higher in the gold price, over 30%, 35% higher in the silver price. So that kind of speaks for itself. But the psychological aspects are actually more important today in the gold market and silver market. What we saw from 2012 until the end of 2015 was, on any basis, positive or negative, it didn't matter what the news was, gold and silver would sell off. It just needed an excuse, and you'd see mass liquidations, not only volatility in the futures market, but follow through on the downside through your exchange-traded funds, massive volumes of liquidations in the exchange-traded funds. Then in January of this year, every possible excuse, positive or negative, even with the gold price dropping, you would see volumes increase on the upside. People started buying aggressively. And I think one of the things that you were seeing in January was this reality which you spoke of. Monetary policy is not fixing the general economy. It may be boosting asset prices and causing sort of a decoupling, if you will, between economic fundamentals and asset prices. But there is a growing awareness among sophisticated investors that, in fact, monetary policy is not a silver bullet. And if it's not going to fix the general economy, then maybe you want a hedge on the downside. Maybe you want some systemic risk hedge, if you will, and you can get that in the precious metals. So we've seen not only a significant change in price since January, but more importantly, a sentiment change where it was very negative for 3 or 4 years, and I think it's now positive again. I think you're consolidating the gains as we speak from the 1370 range, and I just leave you with one very, very important point relating to the gold and silver market. The 65-week moving average, if you're looking at a chart of gold, the 65-week moving average, it turns down in 2013 and marked a cyclical change into negative territory. This is a moving average which takes a long time to turn around, and it has, in fact, turned around as of March to June of this year, May to June of this year. We now have the 65-week moving average turning up. What does that signify? It signifies not several months of growth ahead, but several years ahead. The last time the 65-week moving average turned up like this was back in 2001, 2002, at the beginning of a major move higher, a 10-year move higher. I don't think we have 10 years, but I do think we've got probably 3 to 5 years of growth on the basis of two steps forward, one step back, of course. But I think we've got 3 to 5 years of growth ahead in the precious metals.
Now, do you think that will spill into other commodities? Because the commodity sector, as you know, as a whole, has been very weak for just about a decade now. Are commodities going to look better?
I don't know that it's going to play across all of the commodity space because I think we're dealing with investors moving into gold not on the basis of growth in the emerging markets or growth in China or resurgence of economic activity. But I think people are moving into gold because they have some concerns about the global economy, about systemic risk, about the banking sector. I mean, look at what's happening here in October. As a result of what they call, quote-unquote, macroprudential regulations, Dodd-Frank has insisted, and this is coming about in October of this year, money market funds will move towards floating shares if you're not in a 100% treasury position. That
right.
is a major game changer. In terms
it
of
is.
The way people look at the quote-unquote money that they have sitting on account with brokerage firms and what have you. That means they're going to be taking more risk. Now, the question is, do you want to take that risk? A lot of investors are going to reappraise their cash position and say, well, maybe I want a hedge for our cash position, as well as just sort of general systemic risk. Things like that, Mike and Peggy, I think that's what's going to drive more interest in gold and silver, which is not necessarily the same thing as interest in tin and lead and nickel or what have you.
Okay. David, we're coming on a break, and there's another couple of questions I'd like to ask you both about gold and about inflation. Are you able to stay with us for one more segment?
I'd love to.
That'd be great. Thank you. Folks, we're having a great show today. We've got David McIlvaney with us. As you can tell, the man knows everything about it. It's just fascinating. It's fascinating for me. So stay with us. We're having a great show. Back to you in just a moment. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. Back in a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, before we get any further, I want David to tell you how you can get a hold of. He does what I call a weekly briefing. Now, you know, a lot of people do kind of weekly economic commentaries. In fact, we share a lot of those with you on the show. David's is far more. Oh, God, can't even find the right word. It just covers much more. It's much more interesting. It's different. This week you had Carmen. I don't remember her last name. What was her last name, David?
Carmen Reinhart.
Right. And she was with the New York Fed, connected to New York Fed. We had Danielle DiMartino Booth on her show last Friday, who was assisted Richard Fisher in the Dallas Fed. Both of them fascinating interviews. David, how can they get put on the list to get your weekly briefing?
Yeah, the best place to go is McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. There you can navigate to our commentary website. Carmen Reinhart currently is a professor at Harvard. She was at the Jackson Hole meeting, very involved in the thought process, the PhD think tank, if you will, that goes into monetary policy. She's kind of at the edge of economics and politics at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And fascinating conversation. You need to listen to the whole conversation. It's about an hour long. And towards the end, she's very candid about many of the things that, frankly, she thinks have to happen in order to pick the pocket of the individual via monetary policy. It's a very candid, very colorful conversation.
You know, and you're very intelligent, and you have a very broad-based view of things. Do you think that, you know, that they get up there, like in the Fed and in Washington, D.C., and in Congress, they get up there and kind of lay out programs and things like that without taking much, without taking the average investor, the average citizen in mind? We seem to be on the receiving end of things more often than not.
And you find that in the conversation with Carmen through and through, that yes, in fact, what monetary policy is today is designed to do is to corral investors, corral them and have them take certain actions. Unfortunately, today that means taking more risk. You know, what happened to the magic 5%? You used to be able to save money, move towards retirement, and expect some kind of supplement to your pension or Social Security from your savings. Well, interest rates, being as low as they are now funneling you into higher risk assets. It's funneling you into stocks. It's funneling you into high yield in order to get the income needs that you have. So, yes, you are, in fact, targeted by monetary policy, and they have, in essence, created captive audiences that have to choose arbitrarily A or B. And of course, that's not all the options that you have, but that's how it's presented. And, I think monetary policy and central banking today is disconnected from the man on the street, disconnected from our greatest needs and interests.
You know, when you said the word corral, I just have to, I almost feel like they put in the word manipulate, because I sometimes feel like they're actually manipulating us and trying to hurt us in one direction or another. Let me ask you a question. If I were an investor and I was sitting in front of you today, where would you tell me to put my assets? Where are you investing?
Well, first of all, I think you have to be very cautious in here. If you don't have to play, then I wouldn't. What that implies is getting a lot more liquid. You want to own a lot more cash and view that as a strategic asset, not as a non-invested portion of your portfolio. That is the first thing. You're going to lower your risk profile considerably by increasing your cash allocation. If you can't do that, if you're looking at such low-cost basis assets that you want to hold on to them, then instead I would take a portion of your liquidity today and start to hedge. Hedge your exposure as much as you can. Try to get to a neutral position if you can. We're so convinced that things are overpriced that in the next 30 to 60 days, we're launching one of the most remarkable short funds in the marketplace. I'm very excited about that. We're partnering with a team with 25 years of experience, both in the hedge fund world and the mutual fund world, and have a very, very compelling case in terms of shorting the market opportunistically. I like gold and silver. I like gold and silver. I think we are in a corrective phase right now, and any weakness in price down to about $1,250 on the gold price, I would take as an opportunity to add to position. As I mentioned in the earlier segment, the 65-week moving average has started to move up, and that doesn't happen except when you've got several years of growth ahead of you. So if you are that cautious person who said, look, I don't know if the bottom's in, I'm going to wait and see. I mean, there's a lot of people who look at Harry Dent and say, well, gosh, gold could still go to $700 an ounce. Maybe I want to wait and see. The bottom was put in at 1050. The bottom was put in at 1050. Your major moving averages are now moving higher, and any consolidation between 1350 and 1250, take as a gift and start to position in the metals, because I think the next 3 to 5 years are going to be incredibly rewarding for you, both on the gold and silver side. And
do you have I'm sorry, David. Go ahead.
F you, sir.
Do you have a upside target on gold?
I think over the next 12 to 24 months when we could approach the old highs. 1,900, 3,000, these are sort of near-term targets. But let me just walk you through a couple of numbers real quick.
Okay.
In the 1970s, and you know the numbers on gold and silver very well from that era. I don't have to tell you, Mike,
right,
but just for the benefit of your listeners, $35 is where gold was stuck by government edict as we came into the 70s. It was finally legal to own January 1st, 1975. And it went from 35 up to 190. And then it corrected for about 2 years, got cut in half, sawed in half. 190, it dropped to about 105. And then from 105, it recovered through the late 70s to 875. Now, I know this may sound preposterous, but just work with me on this. If you wrote down those numbers, 35, 190, 105, and 875, consider this. Global monetary aggregates have expanded by far greater than 10 times since the 1980s. Global monetary aggregates have expanded by far more than 10 times. If you just add a zero to those numbers, I think you've got a pretty interesting step sequence. We came out of the bear market in gold, two decade bear market in gold, in the year 2000, 2001, and gold was about $350. Add a zero to 35, 350. We topped out at about 1900. We dropped back to 1050. Again, just add a zero to the old numbers. Do we ultimately get to 8500 on the high side? All I can tell you, Mike, is that you're dealing with a very inelastic market. In other words, as demand comes in, you cannot increase supply fast enough. We're about in balance all the time with industrial and jewelry demand for gold coming primarily from India and China, but you throw in the rest of the world and you produce about 3,000 tons and you consume about 3,000 tons. The swing vote in the gold market is the investor. So the vehicles that were created in the early part, we have the vehicles which I think can drive that price exponentially higher. And again, you're talking about just reflecting an increase in debts in the market and an increase in aggregate money supplies. And I think, yeah, you could see us above 5,000, even as high as 8,500.
Wow. Well,
I know
tell
that
you
sounds
what,
preposterous, but
well,
it's very reasonable in my opinion.
You know, if you'd have told me we'd have $20 trillion in debt, I thought that'd be preposterous, and here it is. So, David, thank you so much for being with
thank
us today
you.
And for sharing your knowledge with the listeners. Folks, thank you for listening. But more than anything else, I hope God blesses you and your family.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.